The Exchange Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England. Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. College basketball's March Madness season wrapped up last night as the UConn women's team beat out Notre Dame. But now, as many sports fans turn to baseball, the legal wrangling continues over the status of those college players whose feats on the court held the nation's attention. The debate is largely about money. While the college athletic governing body, the NCAA, brought in $1 billion last year, many of the young people whose sweat and talent are at the heart of that sum saw very little of it, since they are officially amateur athletes. And that's starting to rub some Americans the wrong way, including President Obama speaking here with the Huffington Post.
Athletic directors getting paid millions of dollars, the NCAA making huge amounts of money, and then some kid gets a tattoo gets a free use of a car, and suddenly they're banished.
Yeah.
That's not fair.
The NCAA says it's taking the criticisms to heart and looking at how athletes are treated, but paying them, says the organization's Oliver Luck, is not in the right spirit of the game.
We think having a class of paid professional athletes within the intercollegiate environment, within the campus environment, would be detrimental to the whole concept of intercollegiate athletics and amateurism.
Today in The Exchange, we study up on student athletics, and let's hear from you. Should players at top sports colleges be paid or get some form of compensation beyond scholarships? Or is the prestige and the experience of playing at the top college level enough? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We had three guests for the hour. Peter Foley is with us in studio, adjunct professor of sports law at UNH Law. And Peter Foley, good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Laura.
Also with us from Massachusetts, Andrew Zimbalist, Robert A. Woods professor of economics at Smith College, author of the new book about the Olympics called Circus Maximus, The Economic Gamble Behind Hosting the Olympics and the World Cup. And Andrew Zimbalist, thank you for your time as well.
Good to be with you, Laura.
And joining us from South Carolina is Richard Southall. He's associate professor and director of the College Sport Research Institute at the University of South Carolina. Richard is also co-founder of a group called CareFC, which is a group of faculty members concerned about how student athletes are treated. And Richard Southall, great to have you too. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Well, gentlemen, I want to turn to all of you for this, but I think I'll go to you first, Andrew Zimbalist. When it comes to the controversies that we're talking about today with student athletes, what are we really talking about, Andrew? What programs, what kind of schools, what kind of players are we really focusing on here?
So there are almost 1,100 schools that are part of the NCAA system, and they're divided into three divisions. The top division, Division I, has 350 schools, and Division I itself is subdivided into three or arguably four subdivisions. The top subdivision is called the Football Bowl subdivision. It has 128 schools in it. These are the schools that are most commercially active and generate the most revenue. Within FBS, there is now a subgroup that's called, usually referred to as the Power Five conferences. That group of the Power Five conferences, which has 65 schools plus Notre Dame, or it might be 66 or 67, they run the football playoff system, the new playoff system that came into effect this year, and they by far and away earn the highest revenues and are the most heavily commercialized. Within that group of 65-plus schools, you have basically men's basketball and football. The average football team has 120 players on it, has 85 full-ride scholarships. Basketball team has 13 scholarships. Of the players who get scholarships on a football team, there might be 2, 3, 4, or 5 of them who are good prospects for the National Football League. And on leading basketball teams, there might be 1 or 2 players who will also go to the professional ranks, to the NBA. It's these players, the small group of football players and men's basketball players within the Power Five conferences who are being heavily exploited in economic terms by the current system.
Well, we'll definitely talk about that idea of exploitation. But just to get a handle on it then, Andrew, it seems like we're really talking about a minority of a minority of a minority, the guys who grace Sports Illustrated and, you know, who everybody watches on TV.
It's a very, very small group. If you're playing college basketball or college football, you've got about 1 chance in 1,000 to make it to the pros. So,
wow.
Yes, we're talking about a minority of players.
And I have to ask you this, and then I want to turn to our other guests as well. Andrew, you mentioned men's basketball and football. Women's basketball, at least at UConn, is pretty exciting, gets a lot of attention. When we talk about this idea of exploitation and money and the commercialization of student-athletes, are we talking about women at all or not?
You know, it depends on the year, but according to the NCAA's own statistics, you have somewhere in the neighborhood of 1, 2, or 3 women's basketball teams. They'll also be from the Power Five conferences, or at least from FBS, Football Bowl Subdivision. You have 1, 2, or 3 women's teams that are generating an operating surplus. All the other women's teams are generating deficits. So it's hard to make the argument for women that they're being economically exploited. That argument might apply to a few women, but we're not talking about the large numbers at all.
Richard Southall, do you think college athletes, again, this especially this elite minority that Andrew talks about, are they being exploited? That's a strong word.
Well, I think clearly they're being economically exploited. They may also be to varying degrees exploited educationally as well, or not allowed access in systematic ways to an equal opportunity for an education. So, but I do think, as Andrew's pointed out, that this is a minority of college athletes who are economically exploited, and that to me is part of the insidious nature of the system, is that we seem to not mind that we're exploiting primarily minority population for economic means.
What do you think, Peter Foley? Again, it's a strong term, exploitation.
Well, from a pure economic standpoint, I don't think there's any question that the student athletes are being exploited. The fact is, and I'm sure Professor Zimbalist can give us more details, but these sports generate, as I think you said in the introduction, $1 billion a year for the NCAA. They're generating huge sums of money for the schools in the Football Bowl series. And coaches are making millions of dollars. The only people not getting paid are the players. And I think if you look up exploitation in the dictionary, that would be a pretty good example.
By the way, you know, a lot of us are focused still now on the March Madness and the college basketball, but the Football Bowl is pretty new, right, Peter? And is that kind of a furthering of this money-making machine?
Yeah, that's been an evolving system. And through some legal wranglings in the 80s and 90s, a group of schools kind of extricated themselves from the NCAA's control of football revenue. And so that whole bowl series is money that goes to the colleges and goes to these Power Five conferences that Professor Zimbalist mentioned. But the NCAA itself does not control that particular playoff.
Do you want to jump in there too, Andrew Zimbalist, on this Football Bowl and the emergence of it?
Well, this year is the first year, and they have a television contract that garnered over $500 million. When the previous system, which was called the BCS system, Bowl Championship Series system, generated $125 million in television revenue. So you've quadrupled the amount of television money by going to this football playoff, and as Peter points out, this is the only postseason playoff in 89 sports, championship sports, that the NCAA sponsors that is not controlled by the NCAA. And that means that the NCAA does not get the revenue. It goes rather to the five power conferences, and they distribute it as they see fit. So it means that basically there's an incentive system that's rewarding teams, rewarding athletic departments for building championship teams and winning on the playing field, rather than for rewarding them for running an educational institution.
Richard, then I have another question for all of you.
Well, and what's interesting in all of this as well, in addition to the revenue generation, are the tax implications for nonprofit status of educational institutions and athletic departments. That's really important because sometimes, you know, we have to remember that athletic departments are not set up as for-profit entities, as has been mentioned a couple of times by athletic department administrators in testimony. They eat what they kill. In other words, they spend pretty much everything that they generate, and that to me is part of the nature of this exploitation that we seem to ignore, is that we're subsidizing a whole host of sports basically off of the athletic labor of football and men's basketball players. And so that's something that we don't really like to talk about a great deal, because the sociodemographics of the two groups are markedly different, and that's a very uncomfortable situation.
Well, talk a little bit more about that, Richard Southall, then. You know, some have said that you do need to look at this subject partly with a racial lens, since so many of these top football and basketball players are black.
Well, there's primarily two sports that are the revenue generators for the system, and quite frankly, football is the big revenue generator. I keep using the same word because that's really what it's about. And those two sports are the sports, excluding track and field, which is an ancillary sport, that are predominantly African-American in participation. And so when you have items that we look at, whether they're graduation rates or other metrics to look at the quality of the education or educational access, you seem to have wide disparities between the graduation rates in those two sports and all the graduation rates of athletes in the non-revenue sports. So I think you have those issues of both ethnicity and class that we should take a look at when we're looking at this system.
Again, our number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Today in the exchange, we're looking at college sports, whether the athletes involved, especially in some of these top schools, are exploited or not. Let's hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. More in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're talking about the status of student athletes and whether that status should change. Some argue that the NCAA should disperse at least a share of its many, many millions among players. Others, though, warn that this would turn college athletes prematurely into professionals. We're looking at this given that March Madness has just ended this week. 1-800-892-6477 is the number. What do you think about this question of student athletes and how they should be compensated, if at all? 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Joining us now on the phone is Luke Bonner. He's a former Division I basketball player, brother of NBA player Matt Bonner. He's also a member of the National College Players Association. And Luke, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me this morning. Well, always a pleasure to be on the NHPR.
Well, and forgive me for not remembering where you played Division I basketball.
I played Division I. I went to West Virginia University, and then I transferred and finished out at UMass. My sister played at Stanford University and transferred to Boston University. And my older brother played at the University of Florida.
And some people say, Luke, that, you know, hey, a lot of NCAA athletes get at least a four-year scholarship. So that's great. Maybe that's enough. You don't need compensation. What did you get to play basketball at your school?
Well, that's exactly the point is, you know, of any family, I guess the Bonner family would be your poster family for NCAA success. My brother, you know, graduated from Florida, summa cum laude, has been in the NBA for 11 years. My sister, you know, got into Stanford with, you know, basketball being a major part of that, and got a great education at Boston University. And then even myself, I transferred. I was able to get, you know, graduate from UMass and also get my master's in sport management. But at the same time, there's just a lot of exploitation going on, and a lot of just you know, poor working rights and everything like that. And so I think when you guys are talking about should NCAA players, Division I players, get compensated, they already are. You do receive that scholarship. And, you know, as such, our argument is that they're employees of the university and have the right to, you know, collectively bargain, you know, some of the working conditions. So, you know, just how a lot of the rules are created and stuff, players have no say in these rules that are governing them. You know, like I remember tearing my MCL on ESPN at Southern Illinois University, and I had to wait till I got back to Massachusetts to get an MRI.
Really?
And it's my parents' insurance, you know, covering that.
Really?
That's a reality. And that's a thing that a lot of people don't know. So when we're advocating for player rights, we're not just talking about, oh, every player deserves $100,000 a year. We're saying you deserve very basic rights that a working human being deserves in the United States of America.
So you're not necessarily, Luke, advocating for pay, but you are saying there are some working conditions that are problematic and could be helped if players were allowed to organize.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And so I started getting into this around 2006, 2007, just sort of on my own. Just like some stuff wasn't adding up. You know, like I knew I wasn't going to the NBA, and I had interest in, you know, starting some, you know, some business type stuff, like a basketball camp, stuff like that. And I keep getting told, no, you can't do that. No, I can't work an internship because I have to be on campus, you know, for summer workouts. I'm seeing my friends at different universities, even like, you know, it's during winter session, the cafeteria is closed and you get a little check here and there to pay for your food when that runs out. Some of these players are, you know, going on food stamps, stuff like that.
Food like stamps, really?
Yeah, you're turning like makers into takers, and this is something that happens, and it's something that people don't talk about. And the sad part is, like, when I think back on that, someone brought it up to me, and I remember stuff like that happening at different universities, but it didn't even like stand out to me. So like I can't even like remember specifics, because to me it was like, oh, that's just the way it is. As a college, you know, athlete, you kind of think, oh, that's the way it is. There's nothing we can do, but there is something you can do. And so, you know, that's sort of where we're at, is just trying to get these players to realize that you can stand up, you can speak out, you can do something about these things. And certainly you're appreciative in all of the education, everything you're receiving, but that doesn't mean you're not being exploited in certain ways. And that doesn't mean you can't, you know, have a say in the rules that are created. And when we talk about collective bargaining, that doesn't mean like all of a sudden players are getting, you know, $1 million
sure.
a year. It means that you're going to collectively bargain. So, you know, it doesn't mean that you're required to pay. But if the funds are there and there's stuff going on, then sure, what's the issue?
And, Luke, I definitely want to bring in our other guests on this pay issue. But since you mentioned, you know, just some of the particulars that people don't think about, you know, the fact that you have to stay on campus when everything's closed, all the food services are closed, you get a little money to cover the food, but then you end up having to cover it yourself. We got a little piece of sound here from Richard Sherman. He's an NFL player for the Seattle Seahawks, talking about his time as an NCAA athlete at Stanford. Let's hear that.
You wake up in the morning, you have weights at this time. Then after weights, you go to class. And after class, you go maybe try to grab you a quick bite to eat. Then after you get your quick bite to eat, you go straight to meetings. And after meetings, you got practice. And after practice, you got to try to get all the work done you had throughout the day. You got from your lectures and from your focus groups. And those aren't the things that people focus on when talking about student athletes. They're upset when a student athlete says they need a little cash. Well, I can tell you from experience, I had negative $40 in my account. And usually my account was in a negative more times than it was in a positive. You know, you got to make decisions on whether you get gas for your car or whether you get the meal for the day.
Yeah, and Luke Bonner, hold on for just a second, if you could, please. Andrew Zimblist, I want to bring you in here. When I heard that sound, I thought it was pretty shocking. I thought, wow, you know, these guys are on TV. They're on the cover of Sports Illustrated. You know, they're famous. How can they be hungry?
Well, I think that what Luke Bonner said is right on the mark. I totally agree with his critique. I don't agree with his solution. I don't think that we can have collective bargaining at the level of the university. First of all, public universities are not covered by the National Labor Relations Act. They're covered by state labor law. State labor law differs across the 50 states. The Northwestern case for unionization, they're a private school. In the FBS, the 128 schools in FBS, I think there are only 19 that are private. So I don't think collective bargaining is the way to go. I do think that all of the deficits in terms of health care and the absence of other benefits and good treatment need to be reformed. But the way to do that is by giving students representation in the decision-making body, whether that body is the NCAA or some other body. And I don't think, and this is something I'm sure everybody will have something to say about, but I don't think going to a system where you actually pay the athletes, and I know Luke wasn't advocating for this, but what's often argued is that we should pay the athletes. I think that would be chaotic, and if you really want to do that, you should do it outside of the confines of the college system. You should create a minor league football league, or you should create a minor league basketball league, and then you can pay them all you want. But if you want to do this under the umbrella of college sports, then it should be part of the college, and it should be rolled into the larger educational effort.
Well, a little bit later, I want to ask our other guests about this idea of just creating a minor league for some of these players like baseball has. But, Luke, one last question for you. And again, thank you for taking time out for us today. You know, some people would hear you, and they would say, well, okay, maybe you should have given a little more money for food over break time, but at least you got that scholarship. A lot of us eyeing the cost of college for our kids are going, wow, you know, a 4-year ride, free ride would be great. So I just wonder, you know, maybe that's enough. What do you think?
Well, free ride is definitely not, that's not the right term. It's certainly not free by any means.
It's not, okay.
Especially when you talk to people like my parents who, you know, put us through. When I was in sixth grade, this is reality. My parents had a talk with me. I was, you know, about 6'2", 12 years old in sixth grade, and my brother and sister were both being, you know, very heavily recruited. So I'm in the gym, and, you know, Coach K's at the Concord YMCA watching my brother do, you know, dribbling drills, stuff like that. And when I'm in sixth grade, my parents, you know, told me, like, this AAU stuff is really expensive. It's, my dad is a letter carrier for the post office, and my mom's an elementary school teacher. You know, we're not wealthy by any means. So they basically had to tell me at that age, if you're going to do this, this is how you're going to go to college, or you're going to or do something else. So I had to tell them, you know, at that age, like, I'm going to get a college scholarship. And so, you know, there's a lot of trips, a lot of money that goes into that throughout high school and everything. You know, and plus, you know, I worked really hard. I didn't go to parties in high school. I didn't have a girlfriend in high school, none of that. My entire, you know, focus was I need to go to college. And that happens in, you know, in a lot of situations. And just to respond to Andrew Zimbalist real quick, is I agree with some of your stuff, but there's really no other alternative at this point. We've done everything. We've done exercise a lot of different avenues with the NCAA and increasing player rights, and we kind of have no choice but to, you know, make the push for the union. And you can already see the NCAA reacting based on what's happened this past year. So that's something I'm definitely, like, really proud to be a part of. And I don't think you can – I mean, frankly, there's just a conflict of interest if you're going to expect the NCAA to, you know, look out for the rights of the players, while at the same time they're the ones trying to generate the most, you know, the most revenue possible, even within the athletic departments at each university. And a lot of and you guys are talking about a lot of these programs operating at a deficit, but there's also, like, significant spending problems. When my coach at UMass can leave after we make an NIT run, and he's making $3 million a year, and I'm still at school. Like, these are things that really happen, and, you know, and he had a rough year at Oklahoma State this year, and there's all these reports about the boosters are prepared to pay $10 million just to buy out his contract. Like, that is insane.
Now, the coaches' salaries are definitely something we should talk about. So in terms of me saying, hey, Luke, at least you got a free ride, you're kind of saying you paid up front. you know, your parents and your family and so forth to get you to that point.
And it's not a free ride. You're working for it. If I don't go to practice, if I decide to take an internship instead of go to summer school and do the weights and workouts and stuff, I can lose my scholarship at any time.
Yeah, so it's like a job, really.
It's a job, yeah. And you're putting, on average, you know, 40, 50 hours a week towards basketball-related activities while you're a full-time student. So it's 100% a full-time job.
Well, Luke Bonner, it's great to talk to you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Talk to you. Thanks.
All right.
Thanks for having me.
Take care. Bye-bye. Again, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Peter Foley, Andrew Zimbalist, Richard Southall, before we go to our listeners, I did want to just follow up on a couple things that Luke Bonner said. And it was great to hear from him, Richard. When you hear Luke talk about player rights, what does that mean to you?
Well, first and foremost, I think we need to look at some of the language that we're using to discuss this and the issues surrounding this. First one is college athletes are actually not members of the NCAA. They're the only individuals involved in the process that are within the athletic department that aren't members of the NCAA. The other thing that's really interesting is the word pay. If you go to NCAA bylaw 12.02.8, pay is defined. And pay is defined as the receipt of funds, awards, or benefits not permitted by the governing legislation of the association. It doesn't. So when we say we can't pay them, of course we can't pay them because we have to approve it. So all of a sudden when we're giving parents $3,000 or a total of $4,000 that make it to the Final Four, that's no longer pay because we've approved, the NCAA has approved that compensation. The other thing is the definition of a professional athlete. The following bylaw defines a professional athlete as anyone who receives any kind of payment directly or indirectly for athletic participation, except as permitted by the governing legislation of the association. So the NCAA is not really against, and colleges and universities are not against compensating athletes. They simply want to control the means of compensation, very tightly control the means of compensation. So while collective bargaining may not be the appropriate mechanism, as Andrew was talking about, because of the National Labor Relations Act, what I think we could possibly do is to use a concept that the Europeans have explored for a number of years called social dialogue. And I'm actually spending a month in Europe visiting with members of FIFPro and other athlete organizations in Europe to find out how they go about negotiating on behalf of players in many different countries that have sometimes many different laws. So I think to simply say that it's too complicated, that we can't do that, is really actually not intellectually honest in many ways, because we can figure this out. But what we have to do is, I think, first treat these athletes as adults. They are not children in the sense that we normally use children. They are, many of them, 18 years of age. They can serve in the military. They can vote. They can sign contracts. And we need to give them a voice in this exchange. And they need to have an equal seat at the table, not representation that is marginal at best.
Well, here's a couple of emails that I want to share with you, maybe get your comments, Peter Foley. Here's Brian in Jackson. He says, seems to me this is yet another example of skewed values in our society. These athletic systems are making obscene amounts of money, yet we keep cutting aid to education. We can afford to pay coaches millions of dollars a year, yet we cut educational funding for people with disabilities. Brian says, we put our entertainment above all else while we ignore the future of our nation. He says the NCAA is just another example of our collected short-sightedness and yes, greed. And then a similar email from Dave. He says, you're discussing college sports at a time when higher ed is facing huge cuts and students are facing staggering, crippling debt. The money should go to schools. This really bothers people, Peter, past shows that we've done on higher education as well. Your average person gets upset when they see the beautiful facilities and the highly, highly paid coaches at a time when their own kids are, as this emailer says, drowning in debt.
Yes. I think the problem, though, isn't limited to the NCAA in this regard. This is a cultural issue within this country and its decision to emphasize athletics over a lot of things, including higher education. And there's just more interest and there's more revenue being generated for sporting events. You know, you used to have the College Bowl academic shows where you'd have students on competing to show their knowledge. That's not a big moneymaker. So where the money is coming from is from athletics. And as a, I think, kind of a natural result, they're going to spend it primarily on athletic programs.
So it's a societal problem. Don't point the finger at the schools per se, Peter. Point the finger at just the broader American society that likes sports and likes to be entertained. Is that what you're saying?
Sure, and prefers to spend their dollars on entertainment of that type rather than agreeing to a tax increase that's going to be earmarked for education.
What about the coaches, Andrew Zimbalist? This comes up a lot, too. And, you know, Luke's right. There's many, many millions of dollars at play there.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Look, what's happening with coaches' compensation is that by suppressing pay to the athletes, and at these big schools, some of the athletes are probably generating a value that's $2, $3, $4, $5 million. And what are they getting? They're getting a scholarship that might be worth $30,000 or $40,000, maybe $50,000 a year. The difference is this massive surplus that star athletes generate, and since they can't be paid, we end up paying the, or schools end up paying the coaches who recruit those athletes, and so the pay that they're getting is first of all, it's part of a competitive system, competitive labor market, but it's an artificial competition because it's happening only because the athletes themselves, the producers themselves, are having their pay suppressed. There's no reason why a coach on a basketball team, say Kentucky or Louisville or Wisconsin, why those coaches should be getting $5, $6, $7 million a year, which is the same level of compensation, basically, that NBA coaches are getting, when the average NBA team has a revenue of $180 million a year, and these athletic, these basketball teams in Division One have $20, $30 million a year in revenue.
And
it doesn't make any sense economically,
yeah.
So it's an artificial
system. I got to cut you off right there. We are going to a super short break, but we'll pick it up in just a minute. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're talking about the status of student athletes, specifically college athletes, and specifically some of the controversy about how top players under the NCAA are treated, whether they should be compensated or at least have more rights. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter if you'd like. And gentlemen, let's go back to our listeners. And Stephanie's calling from Portsmouth. Hi, Stephanie. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Good morning. Welcome. Thanks so much for having me, Laura.
Sure.
I competed in a Division I volleyball program as an undergraduate and was a scholarship athlete. And I just wanted to make the point that not all athletic programs have the same budgets. I distinctly remember many long, very small van rides with a team of 16 women trying to get to Niagara, New York, for volleyball tournaments. And it was a very different experience than, say, what our basketball program has the benefit of being part of. So I just wanted to note that even though I played on Division I program, I was a scholarship athlete, our experience was much different than some of the bigger budget programs.
Well, what's your take then on the controversies surrounding these sort of elite programs and, you know, how these athletes are treated, whether they're exploited, whether they should consider themselves incredibly lucky? I wonder what you think, Stephanie.
Well, I always felt incredibly fortunate. You know, I made my best friends on my team, and I felt like it was a very wonderful opportunity to be able to help finance my education. But as I said, I wasn't in one of these big programs, so I can't really speak to what that felt like. But I can tell you that as a member of a program that wasn't financed in the same way, the inequity was noticed, and to be in these tiny little vans while other programs were flying to different tournaments or taking these luxury buses, you know, it was not fair. And
yeah.
It was, but again, I feel like the experience of having had the opportunity to play a sport I loved and help finance my education was one I would never trade. I also just note that it's challenging. You know, I went through three coaches in my 4-year history at the school. I think that was also a function of budget and not being able to keep a really good coach around. And that affected the quality of the experience in the program. So, I mean, these are tough trade-offs.
Interesting. Great to hear from you, Stephanie. And it reminds me of a question. I think I'll throw this to you, Richard Southall. The idea that, okay, some people said you should pay some of these star athletes that, again, are, you know, plastered all over newspapers and magazines and TV screens in America. But others have said, yeah, but then how do you talk to the other athletes, you know, the ones that aren't quite the star players or the ones that are great players, but they aren't on the star teams, like our caller Stephanie? I mean, some people have said paying top athletes, the football and basketball players, just opens up just a giant can of worms, and you can't get out of that.
Well, it's called capitalism, I guess, which this giant can of worms that we're talking about. And also, I think we need to keep in mind that very few things in life are homogeneous. Yes, experiences are different. Not all college athletes are the same, and we shouldn't talk about them as if they were or are the same in economic sense nor in educational senses. So I think what we need to do is to take a step back, and first of all, I think we might want to revisit what it means to be an amateur and where that whole term started and the historical genesis of it. Second thing I think we should interrogate is the use of the term student athlete and why and when that term was invented. And then we next can take a look at constructing a system that is equitable, not equal, in all senses. And I think all of those things are not impossible at all, but we first need to have an open and honest dialogue on the system that's been constructed, because the collegiate model of athletics, as it was first articulated by Miles Brand, the notion of amateurism is only applicable to the participants, because what he said was amateur defines the participants, not the enterprise. So the collegiate sport model is a highly commercialized, highly professionalized model in all senses, except the athletes are denied access to negotiation and basic human and civil rights. The interesting thing about this is that in many ways we seem to think that employees can't also be students. High number of college students are employees in one way or another.
Sure,
they're working their way through college.
They get jobs at the cafeteria or whatever.
That's right. You know, Steph, doesn't mean that they can't be students at the same time. So simply by saying that we have to keep these athletes that are generating millions and billions of dollars out of the economic system is really avoiding the issue of, are they employees? If they are, then let's deal with it as we need to.
Well, I've got a question for you, Peter Foley, coming out of Stephanie's call and what Richard just said. And then Andrew Zimbalist, another question for you. Peter, Stephanie's call, very interesting. She said, you know, the disparities were noted by, you know, the women in the van versus the luxury bus that some of the other teams were taking. But if you paid college athletes, some of them, the ones whose, you know, games were bringing in lots of cash, wouldn't you run into the potential for lawsuits by other teams that were less exalted, so to speak?
Well, potentially, but I think that the easy answer to that is we're paying athletes who are generating revenue. If your sport is not generating revenue, there's really less of a argument to be paid. One of the big issues, I think, about payment is the question of what is going to happen if these athletes get paid. The NCAA has this big gloom and doom prediction that if you pay the athletes, it will be the death of college sports. No one will want to come to see a college game because they're now professional athletes. It's going to be just like minor league basketball or minor league baseball. And, you know, that's a common refrain that we've heard over the years. Anytime there's been a financial reform in the sports world, Major League Baseball said free agency would be the death of Major League Baseball. The Olympics said payment would be the death of the Olympics. And obviously, Major League Baseball and the Olympics are doing quite well.
So would that be so terrible to, you know, divorce athletics from the academic setting, or at least downplay it a little bit?
Well, that's kind of the unknown. What would be the impact? So there's a factual question, and this issue has a significant legal impact as well, because in the litigation that's been pending The O'Bannon case, which is challenging some of the restrictions on revenue for athletes, and the Jenkins case, which is a newer case, which is seeking a total lifting of any ban on compensation. The defense to these antitrust cases is that if the NCAA did not have a restriction on income or payments of these athletes, that it would have a anti-competitive effect on their business, and therefore their antitrust defense is by not paying, we're creating, quote unquote, a new product that wouldn't otherwise exist in the market. And if you make us pay them, we're not going to have that product. And that should be the not only factual but legal justification for the system.
So what about that, Andrew Zimbalist? I mean, why not create a minor league system for these players like baseball has? Minor league baseball is, you know, relatively successful. A feeder system into the majors and just divorce this whole thing from the academic setting. What do you think? Why not?
Well, I think I'm not against that. And one of the things that we haven't talked about, although I think Richard was referring to it indirectly, is that a large proportion of these athletes who are playing at the top level don't really have any desire to be in college. And their graduation rates, when properly measured, are around 50% or lower. And even that is only after a tremendous amount of tutoring and channeling them into courses that are paper courses. These athletes are coming into the college, and they don't have the adequate preparation. They don't have an adequate background. Many of them have second, third, fourth grade reading ability, and then you put them into these phony courses. It would be much more honest, much more direct, if you just simply said, "Here's a minor league. You guys don't want to go to college. You don't belong in college. It's not good for you. You're living a lie and hypocrisy when you're there. Just go play minor league football, go play minor league basketball." I think that's a preferable system. The problem that I have is when you try to wind all of that into the educational institution and you make it into, as Richard was saying, a capitalist branch of the college economy. We don't pay the first violinist in the college orchestra. We don't pay thespians in school plays. Once you're accepted into a college, we don't use the dollar or the market system to allocate resources. I don't charge students money to get into my class or have them bid to see who can get into my class. We don't use the market system within the college. I don't want to start using it that way.
So it sounds like you're saying, Andrew, it would be preferable to create a minor league system for some of these college athletes.
Absolutely. Yes.
Wow. Okay, let's go back to our listeners, see what they think. Ralph's joining us from Hampton. Hi, Ralph. You're on The Exchange.
Hi, Laura. Good morning.
Morning.
So my comment was just that everyone seems to think that the athletes should be paid while they're playing, with a very scarce emphasis on their education. With all the money that some of these colleges are getting, that maybe they should be guaranteeing the athletes a job after their graduation in their field. And you can comment after I get off.
So if they're going to be taken advantage of, to use that term loosely, guarantee them a job afterwards, Ralph. So so that's, you know, a way of compensating them. That might be a little tough, Pete Foley, to work out. What do you think?
It's an interesting point. I think it goes to the question of what is the real value of this quote-unquote education they're being provided. Some students who are serious students who want to really participate in the education process, like Richard Sherman, would tell you how busy they are and how difficult it is to actually do that. The University of North Carolina scandal that we've seen recently unveiled, involving essentially fake classes where grades were inflated in order to keep student athletes eligible to play, shows another side of that. The whole notion of being paid through education is a difficult one. You know, the comedian John Oliver has a line that education is the only currency that's more difficult to spend than Bitcoin. So I think that's a good point. You get it, but what can you do with it? Do you have the time to actually benefit from it? And if you're getting something that's substandard, what is really the benefit of that?
Substandard meaning sort of a silly courses that don't really mean anything. It's just to sort of shuttle you through so that you can play basketball.
Correct. One of the big courses offered at the University of North Carolina to these students, basketball players, was Swahili.
Ralph, thank you for calling in. You know, Richard, I'd love to hear what you think also about what Andrew said. You know, maybe it would be preferable to have a system of minor league athletes that, you know, that this is just kind of a joke. We're kind of pushing people through and taking it easy on them in college and just hoping that they'll play great ball so that the college can make some money off of it. Let's be honest and call it what it really is.
I think, first of all, being honest is a really good suggestion. It's kind of an odd thing to say in that way. But I think it's also interesting to ask some questions about why do college athletes have to be full-time students? Why do they have to make progress towards a degree at a certain, following a certain rubric? You know, athletes like other individuals that go to college in the current system, may take longer to graduate. It seems to me that what we should do is to allow college athletes in whatever sport it is, to decide what their level of participation is, if they want to be full-time, whether it's full-time athletes, part-time students, full-time. Why do we have to have a one-size-fits-all model? Because you know who's really motivated as a student is a former athlete who just no longer has a professional athletic career. Then he or she are back in the class really focusing on an education as a means to support themselves the rest of their lives. So I think this, we need to look at the system and figure out that it is basically a mythology that's been constructed for some very basic reasons of tax consequences and revenue generation and so on, but it's clearly not a system that is moral in any sense that we might want to use it to look at it from an ethical perspective.
Well, maybe there is a young person, Andrew Zimbalist, who never would have had the opportunity to go to college, didn't come from a family where that was expected. He or she, and as we've said, it's most often a he, gets the chance to play basketball or football and, you know, gets the opportunity to get that college degree that they never would have had otherwise. Maybe that's not such a terrible thing.
Well, I'm all for social mobility, and if there are low-income children, if there are minority kids in the inner city or from anywhere else who are showing academic potential, I think that we should be giving them scholarships to go to college and give them the opportunity to advance. I don't see why those people should be football players or basketball players. More often than not, we're pushing kids through the system who don't want to be in college and don't belong there, and they're only going there to develop their talents and showcase their talents in their mind to make it to the pros. I think it's an insidious system that goes all the way down, as Luke Bonner was saying earlier, how he had to prepare when he was in sixth grade. He had to start preparing and training to be a college basketball player. There are a lot of kids who are getting this signal that if they become a better basketball player, then the rest of their lives will be paved with gold. And in fact, you know, if one in 1,000 high school basketball players make it to the NBA or less than that, you're giving them false hopes. And the signal you should be giving them is really develop your educational skills rather than develop your basketball skills. So I think that, you know, I agree with Richard that we need to have more flexibility in the system, but I also don't think we want to be living a lie. I don't see why you say to a kid, okay, if you want to just take one course a year, that's fine. Go at your own pace. That's not a college system. And if you want to play football under those circumstances, commercial football, the enterprise should be taxed. It shouldn't be getting all of these tax preferences that colleges get. So we have to be clear about what we're talking about.
Well, and here's an email from Mark that I'll close out with, gentlemen. He says, one of the options proposed is a minor league system. How are baseball players, where there is such a system, better off than college players? I'm sure many would exchange their measly pay and long bus rides for a college education and more lush travel plans. So as we head into the baseball season, Mark, thank you for that comment. Gentlemen, lots to talk about and lots more to talk about. We'll close it out for now. Pete Foley, thank you very much for being here. We appreciate it.
My pleasure, Laura.
Pete Foley, adjunct professor of sports law at UNH Law. And Andrew Zimbalist, great to have you. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Andrew Zimbalist is a professor at Smith College, author of the new book about the Olympics called Circus Maximus. And Richard Southall, thank you also for being with us. We appreciate it.
Laura, thank you very much.
Richard Southall, associate professor at the University of South Carolina, co-founder of a group called CARE FC, a group of faculty concerned about how student athletes are treated. This is The Exchange on NHPR.